nice soothing music for your soul on a Monday before talking to Nick on a podcast.
And we're still missing Andre.
Who's that?
Yeah,
Yeah, I don't even know where he is at the moment. I'm trying to get hold of him. I think, anyway, we'll see. All righty. So, how's your Sunday? Good?
Oh, Sunday was awesome. We had a baptismal service.
Baptismal service.
Yeah,
Woo!
man. So
Nice.
we baptized a 14-year-old boy.
Okay.
Yep, so
You
under
say that like you're waiting
16-year-olds.
for. Are you
I know
waiting for
some
my
Baptists
reaction?
disapprove of people who haven't finished going through puberty yet. But if they
Right,
can't
right,
get their
right.
gun license, should they be able to get baptized?
Right. I see where you're coming from.
And one ex-Roman Catholic, older woman in her
Come
sort of later 50s, yeah, which was awesome.
on. Wow, excellent.
Yeah.
That's one for Geneva, right?
Yeah, it's really, really encouraging. So I got to preach on Remember Your Baptism,
Oh,
the
cool.
good old Martin Luther moniker. So that's
Now,
great.
had she been baptized as a Roman Catholic?
Yeah, she would have been. Yeah, very, she would have been a very devout Roman Catholic.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. But before faith, like christened, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Good. Cool. Well, yeah. Well, we did on Sunday. Thanks for asking. Is we just preached and we did the whole normal thing. It wasn't actually that. We didn't have a baptismal service, Nick. So but yeah, no, it was good.
So the powers of the age to come were present through the means of grace.
I know, yeah, that's the thing. It really did. I had a moment because I've just it might still sound this way, I'm not sure. On the but yeah, I've just been sick for the last 2 weeks and I'm spluttering my way through the sermon and we're just doing our thing and just in weakness. The Sundays where you're just like, oh man, I've got none of this. I can't create anything, I can't do anything. I'm just sort of like, and it's just really, it struck me sort of halfway through, just you get those little moments, halfway through the singing and you're about to, like, what's actually going on here? It's quite amazing if you think about it. You've got a group of people in a world that hates Jesus that are here in their weakness and brokenness, and all of us just struggling with our stuff. And we're experiencing in truth a moment that is really essentially like the eternity we will spend together. Where you get this little group that is not like the world, and it's singing to Jesus, this little
Amen.
group, like, and just crying out for forgiveness and receiving mercy and wanting to hear the word. And it's just, it's proof that there is something going on in the inbreaking of the powers of the age to come. I know it kind of sounds, when I say it out loud, it sounds a little bit mundane, but it's, in the moment where it just kind of.
Well, I mean, here's the relevance, Mike, and to put it as a segue, are you saying the church is the only eschatological community and expression
Ooh,
of the kingdom of
ooh,
God on earth?
I like it. I like it. I like where you're going with that one. Yes, that is what I'm saying. And Contra Dovid and company, which we'll talk more about. But yeah, no, that was a good moment for us on Sunday. Anyway,
Fantastic.
I can see you're ready to go. But you want to answer a question? Someone who?
Yeah.
Someone? Yeah.
So there was a question in the YouTube feed when we were discussing, I think it was theonomy, and
Yes.
I was just blowing a gasket in my frustration with regards to progressive covenantalism, and
Right.
a question was put forward. So I'll just read the question, I'll just read the comment, and then we can engage with it before we kick off.
Okay.
So he says, your comments on progressive covenantalism. You framed it as an exegetically derived structure and presented the covenant theology of Klein as historical. Isn't this making the point of progressive covenantalism that covenant theology isn't so much so exegetical as it is historical? It's almost as though the confessions trump the exegesis of scripture. So he's saying to me that, if we want it more biblical, shouldn't we be going with progressive covenantalism? And he seems to think that I set up a polarity between Klein and history versus the Bible and progressive covenantalism on this side. And he goes on to say, I understand where you're coming from, but the historical arguments shouldn't outweigh the exegesis. And for somehow that is an argument against progressive covenantalism. I would appreciate a more full discussion on progressive covenantalism and new covenant theology. So we're not at the point of discussing New Covenant theology, but maybe let me clarify a few points regarding covenantal, progressive covenantalism, just to help our brother here. So let me start off by saying all the good stuff I love about progressive covenantalism, because it is, there's some really, really, really excellent stuff there. You've read it and you would have benefited from all sorts of parts of it.
Mm.
And, you know, their stuff on the New Covenant is exceptional. You know, when I read them on the New Covenant as a Reformed Baptist, I just feel like...
Now, are we I'm talking living... about, like, who are we talking about exactly?
So Wellam. Wellam okay. and Gentry.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. All right. So they're a book on this topic? They got that little book?
Kingdom Through Covenants?
Oh, are we talking about that one? Because they've got another one. There's another little tiny... well, it's not little tiny, but it's called, I think, Progressive Covenantalism or something.
Yeah, there's that one as well.
Yeah.
My comments were... inspired by a Four Views book where Horton does the covenantal view, Wellam does the progressive covenantal view.
Right.
And just from a very summarized number of statements that he made, ugh, I was triggered in all sorts of ways.
Okay.
And that's what he was experiencing, and that's what his comments are responding to.
Yeah.
But so anyway, just to say that I actually appreciate a lot of what progressive covenantalism is doing.
Yeah.
I really appreciate, I mean, if I wanted to give anyone a textbook where they go get some good hermeneutical tools,
mm-hmm.
I think Wellam has just in a very clean way, just mm-hmm. outlined the Christotelic nature of mm-hmm. the scriptures,
mm-hmm.
you know, just looking at Christ as the endpoint. He is the temple. He is Israel. You know, he's just in the most simplistic way. He's really done us a favor in taking Voss and Beale and all of the guys who've done so much hermeneutical work and really simplifying it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that I think is part of the strength of the progressive covenantalism.
Yeah.
And then there's stuff around New Covenant theology, you know, and the orientation towards the new creation for the reason why baptism should be left behind. You know, they're on that same page with us.
Mm.
And so really love them on that. You know, when I read that, I'm just like, ah.
Yes, finally someone's
agreed,
getting
you know?
It. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so I really enjoy them from that perspective.
Mm.
But where I do think the weaknesses in their case, and this is what I was responding to and where my comments were coming from as we were talking about theonomy, is that when Wellam makes some throwaway comments like, you know, well, you know, we just shouldn't really talk about the Edenic administration as a covenant of works. You
yeah,
know, we don't need to do that. It's not, you know, or there's a works grace tension in every covenant, you know.
Exactly. Yeah, which
you know,
is
those
you
sorts
know,
of comments yeah, are, yeah. you know, and then as if that, and then just move on so quickly.
Yes.
And what you've done is you basically trivialized 300 to 400 years of conversation around what distinguishes different forms of covenant theology in a throwaway comment.
Right.
And that's what got my goat.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm not saying the historical trumps the exegetical at all.
Yeah.
If anything, I'm just saying that progressive covenantalism, for all its strengths, is failing on the historical front. It is insufficiently historically sensitive. Mm. And I think it could do much better if it just dug a little bit deeper into the reasons why certain cases do exist for deciding whether it is a covenant of works or not, or, you know, whether it's a works covenant or a gracious covenant, et cetera.
Yeah. I mean, and the thing is, if we take it from Klein's side for a second, you know, what you see there, I think with Klein, what I appreciate so much about him is, you know, you could see he was happy to let the confession go if it got in the way of the Bible, you know, very clearly. And yet what you have is such a robust exegesis. I mean, who on earth could, you know, you could accuse Klein of many things, but not being a light exegete, right? He is just... He is really right there in the deep code of the whole thing, and working it through. And yet, what he showed at the end was the harmony of the historical conversation on these issues. And or at least when I say that, I mean the confession and the law grace antithesis that the confession and Reformed theology has upheld with the exegesis, along with covenant theology at large. I mean, it's not just some dogmatic construct. It's coming out of the text. It's a way to process the bits and bobs of the text. But you know, the one is supporting the other. So Kleinisch, I think, you know, he is in many ways the gatekeeper on that exact point, in that, you know, he is showing how the two cannot just be, you can't just dismiss the one in favor of the other. They are the same and they are working together. But then the other thing is also just to maybe another way to get at this would be to, in the same way one might appreciate any exegetical commentary or, you know, any exegetical work, any biblical study scholarship. I mean, what those guys do is they don't put it together for you, right? So they just give you the data and they go, yeah, well, this is what we're seeing. And, you know, so if you got a nice exegetical commentary, they'll kind of present you with all the things that they're coming across in the text and this and that. But they're not doing the work of a systematician. They're not taking that and sort of putting it, you know, in a concise doctrine for you and helping you to reconcile that with other doctrines and so forth. Many biblical theologians like that are very helpful as well. So you've got, I think of Goldsworthy would be the big example that pops to mind. He just sort of like, again, very, very sort of simple, basic concepts that he was just spelling out without real reference to systematic theology. So you could read that and then go, ooh, this is a whole nother thing, you know, and I've got to take this all my systematic theology. Or you could go, all right, is this basically, you know, opposing at the core what I'm saying at a systematic level, or is this supporting it? And so when I read Willem, I see, sorry, it's the South African W coming through there. And you know, what I see is someone that, you know, could be read in a few different ways, you know? So he makes those comments, but they don't have to be definitive of what he's saying. So, you know, a lot of what I found, if I was coming at it from a strong Kleinian perspective, what they were saying in progressive covenantalism just fit right in. And I let
I agree. I think the exegetical work is great. Yeah.
It just dominates, you know, it's just not as, they haven't made the equivalently powerful argument in progressive covenantalism. So, you know, the one just dominates and gobbles up the other in some sense. So to do that, I think is kind of helpful because that means you're not only reading Voss and Klein and, you know, people in the Reform stream, you got to read everyone. And then you're just sort of seeing, okay, well on these little points. So I haven't seen, I mean, with Willem, I haven't seen, you know, I mean, there are some moments that you could, but especially after having that discussion with him, you know, on that covenant theology panel, I realized, you know, I had read him in such a way that he might have been opposing some dogmatic systematic constructs. But I, you know, in conversation, he's just a lot more chilled about it. And he's like, hey, I'm kind of happy with that. He's just not going there, basically. So,
that's what I felt, not that he was opposing, but that rather he was trivializing what was actually a gospel issue.
Yeah.
If you're not recognizing there's no grace in the covenant of works, then that's where Klein's game is, you know, that's where the whole pushback is against theonomy and so on. And to make a throwaway statement to trivialize all of those discussions is to lose the importance of those discussions as it defends the gospel.
Right. Let's get to it. We've got Klein's response to Dovid and Dovidianism.
Right.
And so this is, obviously, I think if anyone's hanging with us on our most ambitious series yet, we're way into it now. And we've looked at Klein's covenant theology. We're working through my book, Covenant, Lord, and Cultic Boundary. And we're just getting to the point now where Klein's sort of starting to tackle some other covenantal systems. And sorry if that beep's coming through. My goodness, everyone's trying to get hold of me. So we are basically looking now. We've looked at perspectivalism. We looked at theonomy. Now we're looking at Dovid, which is kind of the big one in many ways because it's closest to home. In some, yeah, you know, it's so. It's sort of these are the guys you actually might be friends with. You know, so you want to be careful where you tread. Yeah, exactly. So. Any thoughts you have to kick us off?
Well, I mean, just to double down on that. I mean, this was probably because it's less contrasted and a lot more similar because it shares more common ground.
Yeah.
I found it harder to sort of get my head around.
Yeah.
You know, it took me a little bit longer to see why Dovidianism is right and wrong at the same time.
Yes.
And good and perhaps even slightly troubling.
Yeah.
and the reason it's troubling is not because it's as heretical as something like theonomy, but because a lot more of the people that I hang out with are going to like Dovid.
Yeah. for sure.
And reject Klein for doing it. And that's ah, oh, it's like, oh, it's bugging me from that point of view.
Exactly. I mean, you know, so, you know, if we're teaching at a seminary, we're probably at a Dovidian seminary. If we're teaching at a thing, it's, you know, it's, this is the Reformed world in many ways. It is the dominant, you know, approach to Reformed theology. If you're going to a seminary, you're probably going to a Dovidian seminary. If you're reading a book, it's probably a Dovidian book. You know, it's just, this is the, if it hasn't taken the time, if the author or the teacher or the institution or whatever it is, hasn't taken the time to iron this issue out at quite a detailed level, it will default to a kind of just a, this is, the Lord is sovereign. God is sovereign. Therefore, you know, everything, he just reigns over everything, but we're not theonomists.
Yeah.
And so it's sort of.
So all Reformed non-theonomists are some form of Dovidianism.
Exactly. But, you know, it is a bit more of a technical discussion than that. And I think, you know, this is one area that hardcore Dovidians and Kleinians can both appreciate, because I think Dovidians get frustrated on this as well. You know, he did say some things, he didn't say some things, and then people have misread Dovid, started their own thing in the name of Dovidianism, and then Neo-Calvinism is sort of a broader version still. And you know, who is the reference point? Is it Kuyper? Is it Bavinck? Is it Dovid? You know, so what's going on? I think the waters do get muddied and frustrate a lot of people. So hopefully just a little thought around this area is helpful one way or another.
Definitely.
You know, I think what I like about the chapter that I managed to get out was that, at least to my satisfaction, you know, I was able to pinpoint some areas where I'm like, okay, well, this is going to be for me the stickler, you know?
Yeah, definitely.
And that's so great. Hopefully other people,
maybe just to orient those who are tracking with us, just to say that Dovidianism is in the Dutch Reformed camp of thinking.
Mm-hmm.
So there's Abraham Kuyper, and here we are downstream of Abraham Kuyper.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a sort of a neo-Kuyperianism that's going on in the Dutch Reformed world. And so Klein and Dovid are both downstream of Kuyper.
Yes.
They're both they're both nuancing his overarching worldview project.
Mm-hmm.
And they're both in agreement with some of the fundamental ideas around God's sovereignty, the basic ideas around sphere sovereignty. So that's where the discourse is taking place.
Yeah, good. And also that Klein himself was appreciative of all of that, and, you know, didn't feel like he needed to just break out of that whole environment, but was, you know, happy with the, I mean, even, you know, much of what we talk about typically is very close to Kuyper's sphere sovereignty. And, you know, there is just a lot of that's really good and gold. I mean, common grace, as we've said before many times, I think we said it recently, was, you know, it's basically a Kuyperian kind of thing. And so all of this has been, you know, in this Dutch Reformed way of thinking. Of course, Voss is Dutch Reformed. Everything's Dutch Reformed. It's kind of operating in this milieu. So there's that. And also there's this matter of just trying to appreciate how all of life does fit together in a Christian worldview, you know, without getting too technical about that and, you know, appropriating a certain sort of, I don't know, Kantian philosophy and so forth. There is just, I think most Reformed Christians get that. We're like, yeah, it does matter. You know, you do have to see the whole thing together, not only in terms of the Bible and how it fits together, but how that then works together in all of life. You want to know how it works when you go to the shopping mall. You want to know how it works when you face things like Christmas, at least. You want to know how it works when you talk about politics. So that's all, you know, this has been a massive discussion in these areas. And, you know, Dovid has perhaps done more than most to help people along in that. And even on the issue of natural law, you know, something that we're obviously okay with, you know, in some sense, I think it was Van Drunen that said Dovid was, you know, just like cultivating this monstrously, you know, more detailed version of natural law than anyone had ever tried to do before that, you know? So even in that, when viewed through that lens, it's something that's potentially really helpful. So that's just something to keep in mind as we get going here.
No, great. Well, I mean, one of the things with Dovid is the learning curve in terms of some of the definitions and the big words and the, you know, just using ideas that maybe aren't mainstream, but are very important to get a handle on. So maybe we should just touch on some of these. So cosmonomic philosophy.
Nice. I like the way you went for the English version of that. That's good.
Yeah.
Yeah, we got Weltanschauung and
Weltanschauung, yeah.
all these German concepts. Yeah.
Worldview,
Because
yeah.
basically a lot of this is you know, as the term worldview, you know, we throw it around regularly, but it came from Kant, and you know,
Yeah.
then it was adopted by some Christian guys by James Orr, and then Kuiper got hold of it, and then it became like a Calvinistic idea. And in the process, you know, one of the critiques of this whole approach is that it really just imbibed a little too much of all of that, you know, that philosophy that was so mainstream at that point, that they were interacting with it so much that, ironically, you know, even though they wanted to break away from it, it ended up just, you know, filtering into the whole way of processing it. You know, I don't want to take that too far, because I think, you know, it was just a means of thinking about something rather than anything else. But you know, at the same time, I think there's always a danger in that they're using categories that are perhaps just a little bit forced, if you had
Yeah.
to rely
I
on the
mean, I
Bible
welcome
alone.
the project because, you know, the Enlightenment coming out of the age of, you know, where Christendom was on the wane,
Yes.
and suddenly you're trying to put the whole world on a new footing, an intellectual
Yes.
footing that's not the assumed categories of Christendom.
Yeah.
You know, the philosophers are putting concepts out there. Now Christianity is seeking to engage with this new intellectual climate. And it's in that conversation that they're beginning to want to carve out the Christian way of using your categories, but this is what it should look like. And so, I mean, I commend the project from that point of view. I think it's what we have to do in every generation. But like you say, there's always the danger of when you use their categories, there are certain assumptions in their categories, and they're inevitably going to influence you.
Yeah, exactly. So there is a kind of I think Fesco helpfully talks about it as a kind of benign worldview theory, where you know, what we've just referred to now, in that you're just wanting to see how it all fits together. Just give me a way to take the Bible and relate it to all of life. Don't leave any part out, you know. But then there's another kind of Kantian idealist version of this that is not benign. That is very, you know, malicious, or whatever you would say. And that's that everything must be reduced to a single principle, you know,
Yes.
and that even an Archimedean point that is not, you know, completely within the biblical mode of thinking is going to create dualism, and you have to have a monism. There must be a structural
Yes.
monism of all things. And so these kinds of ideas are just like a little bit more than anyone would think to have said about it, unless you had some sort of philosophical sort of drive moving you along on that. You're seeing a problem if that's not the case. And
Well, it's like the problem of the one and the many, you know, sort of.
yes.
Then you try and make that, you know, you try to fit the every philosophical and theological discussion that's ever taken place under, you know, the umbrella of the one or the many, you know,
Francis
and you
Schaeffer
try and
comes to
slot it
mind.
all in,
Yeah,
you know.
yeah.
That's
Totally.
the magisterial use of philosophy, not the ministerial use of philosophy.
Yeah. Good. Good.
Yeah.
So, and you mentioned the cosmonomic project, or the cosmonomic philosophy that he came up with. I think one of the things that we'll see as we go on is that probably that lent too much on this monistic sort of, like, it has to
Yeah.
have this one single structure. But insofar as it stood, it was really, you know, and it is perhaps helpful just to think about this. You know, it was this idea that God created all things, right, with certain norms in place, you know, together with the creation come these laws and norms, which I think any natural law sort of, you know, person can appreciate to some extent or another, or just physics or anything, you know, they're sort of reducible to these certain spheres, and each one has their own dimension to it, and, you know, for lack of a better description. And it was part of the job of Adam, as the one who had dominion over these things, to discover these things, you know, to look into them, to sort of be the priest and the farmer and the king and the scientist and the, you know, just be the guy that investigates and discovers. There's a joyful process of learning and discovery and figuring these things out, so as to, as Klein himself said, apply the maximum of his brain and brawn to the task of global mastery. So fine, no problem. That part is clear enough. And do we deny that those things were part of? No, of course, that's perfect, no problem. the trick comes in that obviously when the fall took place, you know, you've got a complication there in that how do we now go about that task? And then as we were talking about the other day, when we looked at neo-Calvinism in general, you know, you've got to almost ask what the goal of that original task is up front. Mm. You know, what was the goal? Just to develop a sort of utopian society. And once you've sort of mastered these laws, that's really, you're just living in there for all eternity? Or was the goal to get to something that really, however we want to talk about it, it transcends those creation norms. It becomes a new creation. It's a sabbatical structure rather than a quotological sort of ideal structure. And if that was the case, even before the fall, if you do have this whole, you know, this mandate to master the atoms, that was to lead to a Sabbath reality that is beyond that, then that is important for this discussion as it goes forward, because that then becomes the whole sort of dividing line. I think you've got within this cosmonomic philosophy another idea that is commonly referred to amongst neo-Calvinists, and that is the structure direction distinction. Mm. In yep. that God creates the structure, and when the fall happened, the structure itself is not compromised, right? So it's not that now we have to throw this world away because of sin. The world itself is still fine, the laws are still there, and everything's still, you know, in place, but there is now a change in direction. And so the idea amongst Dovidian scholars is just to go, we see the problem with sin. It presents this great antithesis, but it doesn't throw the world away. And so if Christ redeems us and changes our direction, then it just remains our task to, you know, to go ahead and develop those creation norms, you know, as before. Yeah. So it sort of puts us back in the garden immediately, and we just keep going, you know. And so Klein, let's just, you know, we can chat about this from this point, I think, because Klein, what he does is good. He comes along and he goes, even the fact that he'll talk about it this way shows he wants to work within these categories. He says, you know, there is a structure and direction distinction. That's fine. I got no problem. I appreciate what Dovi is trying to do with this whole worldview thing. All that's going to do after a fall is just show that the common grace institution is now legitimate. You know, that's all that we're proving there. We're still not getting to what the Sabbath structure is all about, you know? So if anything, he's just using everything David said there and saying, yeah, good, fine. That's why we don't have to rebel against the common grace institution. It's there precisely because it retains its structural integrity. So fine, to the degree that our direction is, you know, changed by Christ and his work of redemption, that will then affect positively the structural integrity of common grace, and we'll work for its embeddements and, all these things that common grace are for. But we just haven't touched the question of what it is that new creation is, because ultimately what Jesus gets us is not just a time back in the garden and a time, you know, back to work on the city, but ultimately what Adam failed to ultimately enter into, which is that teleological Sabbath glory. And that's what now is in focus. And that's what Klein feels is the problem. Like he has missed that, you know, he's got no place for that. And there are other elements of biblical data that he's missed too, according to Klein.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, just, I appreciated the structure direction sort of distinction there. Mm-hmm. You know, when you're looking at the world and you look at it in terms of its structure, so you've got things like maleness and femaleness. You know, the world's all abuzz about that at the moment.
Yes.
And Dovid saying, amen, that God put that in place. That's part of the structure. That mm-hmm. doesn't change. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got marriage, you've got childbearing, you've got work, you've got the development of culture. Mm. These are all things, these creation ordinances, those creation norms all belong to the structure. So, I mean, you know, but the direction, sin hinders the direction. So here's a good example. So divorce would be upholding the structure, yet changing the direction.
Yeah.
But homosexual marriage would be violating both the structure and the direction.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. And so this, you know, so we would have full agreement. And this yeah. it's a useful tool for analyzing these sorts of sins exactly. and situations. Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
So I mean, I think it's great.
Yeah. Well, and even on that, I mean, what a useful tool for Common Grace Institution, you know, arguing at what we're shooting for there, you know. And I mean, sure, we might not take that exact argument when in that public sphere, but, you know, for understanding and analyzing and dissecting and seeing where we disagree and agree and what is permissible, even in a Common Grace scenario, is, you know, it's massively useful. So I think Klein was seeing all of that. Yeah. So I think that we need to make that clear, you know, that this is, it was never, you know, anyone's intention to sort of back away from that and go, the whole thing's broken, whatever. But now we come back to this whole issue of all right, well, if there is any philosophical underpinning that's driving this, then, you know, that it's gonna clash with some biblical detail. We've already mentioned the Sabbath thing, which is perhaps not spoken of enough in the literature. But one thing that I'm really thankful that Klein does get at in Kingdom Prologue is this whole, you know, this there, even just if you think about post-fall, I mean, you know, now we have this reality of eschatological, not only blessing, but judgment, right? And so intermediate state, eschatological hell, you know, these things that are now in view, which are defined specifically as those things which are outside of the kingdom. In other words, they don't fall within that structural sort of monism. God is explicitly mentioned as the Lord over those in hell. The problem is not the devil and his party down there. You know, the problem is the Lord and his wrath and his presence to bring judgment for all eternity, right? So the whole, you know, he is completely sovereign over all of that. And yet it is explicitly said to be outside of the kingdom. So that creates a categorical sort of thing that you've got to deal with now. And, you know, all the discussion, as Klein points out, about the, you know, we can't have common grace because common grace, you know, for example, I've written here for Dovid, the Christian ground motive, which alone provided the possibility of true coherence. He thought all religions other than Christianity were compromised because they'd brought in this dualistic perspective. But only Christianity could bring a true coherence. Well, did you hear that? Okay, good. Someone just thundered across the road and some like engine backfire or something. only Christianity could bring this coherence through its ground motive of creation, fall, and redemption, right? And yet he was frustrated that even in Christianity, Roman Catholicism had sort of returned to some sort of weird version of it, and the Reformation had compromised through the scholastics and whatnot. And so you know, he was trying to get back at this whole thing. But part of that meant that if you bring in common grace, if you talk about a natural law, if you do any of that sort of stuff, it's like basically going back to this dualistic understanding of things, and it's not coherent. So he showed his antipathy for that idea very clearly. And when you know, you have basically Klein present his views, he's saying any talk against common grace as a different sphere, or what is the word I'm looking for? A different realm, or probably not realm. Yeah, different realm. a different category, or something like that. Just, you know, any talk that is dualistic, just it's sort of like dealing with the tiny problem when you've left this massive problem completely open. And then what about hell? I mean, that is like, that's the big one that you have to approach, you know. And then this is just the minority form of what changes structurally after the fall. You know, this is just the tiny little thing that God has to tweak. What about the big one? So I think you know, I have never seen a Dovidian come back at that point. We'll talk more about it when they do come back.
I mean, my basic feel is that it's a case of radical continuity between Eden and this world. So Eden, everything was the kingdom of God. And then you have a fall, but now everything is still the kingdom of God. Common grace, you know, basically functions for believers, not unbelievers. And basically we just continue with Adam's project unbroken. And when Christ comes, and here we are as the church, Christ has secured all the capital which will enable us as the continuers of Adam's mission to basically take over the world and finish off Christ's work. Or finish what Adam, where Adam failed. So Christ enables us to finish Adam's task.
There is this toleration of the unbeliever, you know, it is a co-belligerency
Yes.
But it's for the purposes. It's just sort of there's no sense of it being legitimate at any sort of common grace institution. Rather, it is illegitimate yet tolerated for the purposes of advance of this kingdom. You know, so it's all one kingdom in that it's all, you know, it's never been anything other than. But there are some impasses in this one kingdom that are being tolerated right now as the kingdom advances. Which is again very, very different to what we're saying here with Klein, because he's going, no, the duality exists. God is Lord. He is free to amend the structure of creation, right? Not in such a way that it makes it illegitimate, but in such a way that allows for a certain duality. Yes, we can say that word, and you know, if nothing else, we think about judgment, we think about intermediate state, we think about those areas that are outside of the kingdom that are still under the lordship of Christ. Well, how much more then in these areas that are retain their legitimacy in common grace and yet are not the final thing that Christ has earned for us. So I mean, this is like you know, as you start talking more on those ideas, I think that you can start seeing where the real problem comes in. And you know, this I think is the most helpful way to approach it, because a lot of this discussion goes, well, is a Christian, you know, how is a Christian going to meaningfully interact with his society as like a teacher? Is it your calling? Is it your vocation? Is it, you know, what are you doing for the kingdom of God as a teacher, you know, or a builder or a whatever? And it sort of like gets away from the issue in that sense, you know, because everyone sees that you got to be salt and light and you've got to do this thing. And yep, there might be some nuance in the way that you approach it. Like, you're not going to call your business Kingdom Builders and so forth, or the Kingdom Teachers Association. You're just going to try and be a good teacher. But, or maybe there's also some distinguishing to be made in terms of, you know, whether we would see all vocations as callings. Maybe there's a discussion. I mean, those are worthwhile discussions to have, but they're not the defining issue, because you can still get really clear on that and you're still completely, you know, lost on the bigger picture idea. So I think it's a much better thing to just start off with this redemptive story and just to go, okay, well, what exactly are we doing now? What is the kingdom? Is it the same thing as the city? Is the kingdom now just a more like hyped up supernatural form or holy form of what the city actually is? Or is there a fundamental difference?
The way I encountered it when I was at Bible college is basically, you know, they would say, well, look, in the past, you know, Roman Catholicism had the nature grace dualism and there was the sacred versus the secular. Mm. And then the Reformation told us that there is no longer sacred or secular. Mm. And God is the Lord of every sphere. And now we do all things to the glory of God. And therefore, everything is kingdom.
Yes.
And, you know, and that just that, you know, as you chuck all of those, you know, axiomatic statements together, it's sort of, you know, it sounds okay. There's some lots of, I basically agree with all of those statements as properly intended.
Yeah.
But, you know, it becomes a way of annihilating common grace.
Totally. And so one of the things that Klein called for, and I think he's right to do this, is go, what you're feeling when you hear statements like that as a Christian who believes in God's sovereignty and lordship and so forth is right. So put that in this thought train of the reign of God, you know, call that the reign.
Yeah.
But then in terms of where we get specific in common grace and special grace and church and other institutions, that's the realm, you know? So there's a, you know, God is Lord over all realms and that is his reign, but we're talking now about something slightly different when we want to actually define the realm itself.
You need a two ages rubric.
Well, at because very minimum,
this evil age.
Yes, yes.
And then there's the age to come, which is breaking in the eschatological community of the church.
Right, good. And that two kingdom thing is really focused on the this age idea, right? So what is happening in the this age, you know, as the kingdom breaks in? And we're saying that it's breaking in, but it's not breaking in. There's no continuity between, you know, kingdom plumbers and what we're seeing, you know, being established in society beyond in the age to come. Rather, what we're seeing is a new humanity breaking in now in Christianity. And I think in terms of the organism, here's another helpful thing that was brought in, the organism and the organization. So Kuyper himself, you know, he said, listen, every Christian as part of the church is an organism of the church, you know, and then you have the organization of the church. So no one's, even there, you've got all this overlap. Everyone's saying that you know, the kingdom is breaking in the organism of the church, right? So, and that's bigger than the church, right? So that's you as you go out into the world as salt and light.
Yes.
But then here's where it really gets down to the stickler. The only place that we're seeing the kingdom at an institutional, organizational level break in now is the church. And that's the do-all and end-all of this debate, I think.
Yes.
Because, you know, the minute you want to say that, no, that is broader, it's also, you know, kingdom bicycles or us, you know, and kingdom plumbers. And then that's where it gets, that effectively takes away the special nature of the institutional church at this point as the thing. That
if everything's holy, nothing's holy.
Exactly. So there is, in fact, a secular sacred distinction, right, at that level. But, you know, people mishear that. You know, and that,
yes.
Well, what are you saying?
I think we're saying God's not king somewhere.
Right. God's
that's
not king, or Christians aren't everywhere, or like.
And they also think we're saying that Christians shouldn't do work well to the glory of God in those areas.
Right. Or now they can just, if secular culture is legitimate, then just have at it, you know, go and binge watch whatever you want. And, you know,
or they think we're saying that there's a neutral space where God's laws don't matter.
Exactly. Exactly. And so you've got to, you know, the language has perhaps become a little bit unhelpful in that regard.
Yeah.
But it still has the shock value of making the point, which ultimately needs to be made, you know, that there is some sense in which you taking communion is not at the same level as you mowing your lawn. You know, you've got to just appreciate that there's something sacred and something secular going on.
Yeah.
And one of the ways that you can get at this is that everyone can mow their lawn and it does not affect anything. And yes, you can subjectively, internally mow your lawn to the glory of God, but you know, there is something that, you know, is going on in your participation of the means of grace as a member of the church that is different.
I think what it does is Klein's view really, really raises our ecclesiology, because it distinguishes the church and the importance of the church, its distinctiveness in culture and its role in culture.
Yeah.
Because what it's basically saying is that, you know, our coming together for worship as the people of God, to sit under the means of grace, to enjoy the powers of the age to come, to manifest the finished work of Christ through what we are.
Mm.
By this, the world will know that we are his disciples by our love community that we're building as his people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that is the light and the salt in this world. But we can't equate that with what we do on a Sunday with what we do on a Monday. You know, when we go to work, let's say I'm the mayor and I go be the mayor of a town. That work is not equal to the work that's going on in the church. This is common work and this is holy.
Yeah.
You know, and we need to recognize the difference between those things. But the trouble with Dovid's everything is kingdom, it's basically it diminishes the distinctiveness of the church. And so perhaps I don't know why people couldn't say to themselves, well, I mean, I'm just going to worship God by sweeping the street today instead of worshiping God by going to church today.
Well, I mean, this is kind of the way it's gone, I think. And that's the problem. And, you know, you hear a lot of neo-Calvinists that appreciate, they typically, this is their opening line. Well, we've got many bad things to say about two kingdom theology, but the first thing we got to say is the way it makes the church, you know, it puts the church in its own space and you know, upholds that ecclesiological element and so forth. And, you know, so they're feeling that, you know, one of the problems on their side is that it just, you know, nothing, everything's holy, nothing's holy. That issue leads to a very practical, like, why are we going to church exactly? And what is this, you know, what is the point of this? And then a politicization of the church. In order for it to be relevant, you know, it's not that you can just do worship. You've got to make it relevant in that it equips you, you know, or something. There's got to be something that helps you do kingdom work elsewhere. And so there's this whole, you know, movement, backwards movement on that point.
So what we're saying is we need a cultic boundary.
Yes. Yes, yes, yes.
So this, hence the name of the book.
Yeah. Well, Klein felt frustrated that they were saying in the name of the covenant law, they were upholding the covenant Lord and saying, you know, God is Lord over all of life. And in the name of that proposition, saying that, you know, they had failed to appreciate the very cultic boundary that the Lord himself had put into play. You know, and so this is kind of this. I think we talked about this with theonomy, a similar sort of thing. Yeah, in that it's, you could tell this is a big frustration for him. If he's Lord, just let him be Lord then and tell you what's up.
Yeah.
You know, he, you
don't
know,
tell the Lord how he can be Lord. Is he Lord or not?
Is he Lord or not? And if he's Lord, then he said this is legitimate. And then, you know, he's doing these things, and don't try and let your philosophy rule the day with this stuff.
Yeah.
I love this. The brilliance of the author that wrote this line is just shocking to me. It's just, you know,
who's the author, Mike?
I don't know. No, but this is one of my favorite little, this was important to me as I was writing it. Klein did not want to equate the structural legitimacy of creation, which is good about David, with the redemptive sanctity of the new creation.
Yes.
And so to the degree that that encroaches and intrudes in this age, I mean, the same issue is at play.
I mean, David's system lacks a true doctrine of consummation.
Yeah. And that's not to say that Doevians don't have that doctrine.
No, no, but the necessary distinctiveness,
yes,
of
it's sort
biblical
of
biblical distinctiveness of that doctrine.
Right. And it comes through. I mean, I realize when we talk about the ground motive idea with creation, fall, redemption, it's more philosophical than biblical theological, but still it is kind of curious that there isn't a creation, fall, redemption, consummation.
Yeah.
That would help a lot, you know, if you just put that there. It would lessen the concern that everyone has on this issue, and that it doesn't feel like it's necessary even to have a consummation under this Dovidian rubric. So there's that. I mean, that basically gets at what we're saying. I suppose the whole thing with you know, as Klein responds, is I wrote here that there are important points of disagreement, you know, the important points of agreement. So it's in-house, but disagreement first. Klein's not willing to identify the common grace order with the holy kingdom of God. And that's a big deal. This is because the redemptive kingdom, in his view, is not merely a directional return to the structural norms of creation.
Yes.
It's more than that. And that really, for me, that comes down to the actual, like, literal substance of this whole debate. So, the point there is not to be contentious, but just to go, okay, let's talk about that. You know, if we can find alignment on that, maybe someone needs to change, maybe not. That's the big deal. And I think
I think you put it this way, and maybe you can expand on this, because it's using Kleinian categories that are helpful. You know, to take us back to creation is to build megapolis, not metapolis.
Yes, exactly. You know, at best, if you know, which is like even in doubt, like, can we even do that? You know, because you would not, in order to get megapolis, you would need no sin, you know, yes, to be in existence. That was the original deal there. But let's say that the directional return in redemption brings us to, like, not even having remaining sin in some sense, you know, in society and personally, and sanctification just leads to such an enormous point that could even be achieved. Which I already, we're on shaky ground there.
Yeah.
But let's just.
That's where idealism really creeps in.
Right. And so, but let's say you could do that. That would only be megapolis, which is not the point, you know.
So the world at best can only ever be megapolis.
Yeah.
Without the eschatological. If we're taking it back to creation, creation's full potential.
Yes.
Is megapolis, not metapolis.
Right. And even without sin and Adam's full enjoyable sort of process, it was still, Klein argues, and I think he's right, it was still reliant on this whole, now God brings the final consummation.
Epiphanic flesh.
Yes. And this,
he brings really, it into the resurrection, the new creation.
The thing imaged by man is that God goes from work into rest, right? He enthrones his Sabbath glory, and he invites man to join him. And that will never happen. Man can never build a Babel Tower, basically. There must be God descending. There must be God doing what he does to heavenize the earth, ultimately. And at that point, you know, look, Klein saw very little continuity, even with that cultural, you know, thing in place. Let's say all the holy cultural aspects of a megapolis creation, even that had very little continuity with what that so super far above heavenized state looked like. You know, yes, there would be continuity, but even there it would struggle. So how much more then for when we're dealing with a the discontinuity issue with a common grace structure that's dealing, that's managing sin effectively. It's a negative process from begin from the ground up. It's just restrain, restrain, restrain. You know, don't let this get too bad. Be realistic about this. Be penultimate in this. And you know, so to even think in terms of what it is that is now being foretasted in the church and will be experienced for eternity as being continuous just by our cultural labors is just, you know, crazy. And
I think that's a helpful insight by Klein, because he's basically saying, okay, I'll let you have your cake and eat it.
Yeah.
Let's go back to creation. Let's give it its structural and directional integrity.
Yes.
And it still doesn't get there. It can't. And, so you're still minus the eschatological consummation.
And he gives more of a cake too. He basically says, let's do it. I think it's a good idea. This will be great for coming grace. So let's go and figure out, like, I think David's done an outstanding job in like really tracing out some pretty, you know, true things that are just amazing about the way the world works. And the more that we can know about this, the better, because we are under a mandate, you know, to master the atoms in the Noahic sort of refracted, you know, cultural mandate. So go. Yeah, that's a good set of tools right there. But even, you know, do your best. all it's going to do is ameliorate, you know, this fallen condition for a certain amount of time.
I think people don't appreciate that is Klein is willing to put the mandate into cultural mandate.
Oh, totally.
You know, go do it, but just you can't do it to the same end that Adam originally could have in the context of a covenant of works. We had a different covenantal context, therefore it's a refracted cultural mandate.
Right, exactly. So go do it. Go. And who should I read when I do it? Well, read Van Drunen, read Tovet, read whoever you know, read them all.
Because have modest expectations about what you can accomplish through your work.
Right. And that's really where we're more on. You know, so to be fair, Dovid was not saying that. You know, you have this, like, there is this latent, like, optimism that's just, you know, oozes in everything. And the idealism, I think, at that point is driving it. Whereas if you read Van Drunen, even where they're overlapping on natural law principles and so forth, Van Drunen's very clear, but very consistent sort of, be realistic about what is meant to be attained here, you know?
Yeah.
And people say that that's defeatist and whatever, but no, that's what that is, if anything, encouraging to actually get stuck in and do something, because you might actually achieve the goal at that level. You know, you don't have to delude yourself into thinking that we're in basically a Christian political society anyway. You can actually, in a really pagan scenario, no matter what the level of society, you can get stuck in and hope.
And you can shine your light for Jesus through your daily work.
Right. And even in politics, like, you could get stuck in and achieve modest little things that really make a big difference. And that is a success in the rubric of common grace.
So one of the things you bring out is the difference between the subjective sanctification of culture in the life of the believer.
Yes.
And not the objective sanctification of culture. Maybe let's elaborate on that.
We're sort of touching and on again, it now. That is just a helpful way to kind of mesh into the discussion, you know, a lot of the good of what you're reading in a kind of neo-Calvinist kind of book and rhetoric in general, where they're going, guys, let's get out there. Let's shine our light. Let's be salt. And you know, so because it goes a little bit further than that, the tendency is to reject all of it. But he's saying, no, they're absolutely right. Insofar as all of life, because God is Lord and you are the church out there in the world at an organism level, right? Every part of your life is now not done to some, you know, neutral in the presence of some neutral reality, but, you know, you're washing dishes to the glory of Christ. You know, you're doing all of those things. You whatever your job is, you're doing it as worship to Him. So all of those basic biblical things, no one's trying to get away from those basic biblical injunctions, but it's subjective. Right. And so it's
in the life of the believer.
It's in you. Right. Even that might not be, I mean, it's objective in the sense that you're real. Right. But it's in you. It's not making the plate that you're washing a kingdom plate, you know, that now has its, you know, worth in this great big redemptive thing. That plate can be thrown in the bin, and, you know, that's fine. We will have other things in heaven. You know, the point is that you have subjected you have subjected all things to Christ, and you've worshiped in that, and that you yourself are going to be the matter of the new creation. You're going to be the thing that makes it through.
And just layering on that is basically, you know, let's go back to washing that plate, because that's such a mundane activity, but let's do it to the glory of God. So let's talk in terms of category of transformationalism. So the believer as he is, doing it to the glory of God, independence upon the Holy Spirit, manifesting the fruit of Spirit, is birthing in this evil age some of the substance of that new age through his sanctification.
Yes, exactly.
So there's real transformation happening from one degree of glory. We're being conformed to the image of Christ. The glory of Christ is shining in our character as we apply ourselves as that mother washing the dishes again.
Yes.
As she serves her family in her God-given role to the glory of God.
Right.
She is subjectively experiencing transformational things.
Right.
But their plate's not being transformed.
No. Exactly. Yeah. And it's, you know, it's what we've called sanctification.
That garbage that comes off the plate is not holy garbage.
No, exactly. As the whole, I think Horton said, you know, the stir fry you're making to the, you know, to the glory of God, you know, it's not unique to Christianity. A Hindu, you know, believer can make good stir fry and it could taste exactly the same.
In fact, it could taste better.
It could probably would. Let's be honest. and that affects nothing in this whole thing.
But yours will glorify God more than theirs because you're in Christ. You're doing good work, and so on and so forth.
Exactly. And, you know, so we're saying all this transformation doesn't happen in purgatory. It happens here, right? And it's sanctification. And
there is no purgatory, Mike.
There is the burning away of fire, and pur means fire. So I'm just kidding. But yeah, I mean, so the idea here is that what we've called sanctification is really, you know, it's totally malleable with this transformation idea subjectively.
Yeah. We just got to put transformationalism in the right place.
Yes. We like that. That's good.
So we're agreeing with their basic notions. You know, they have a positive view of Christ's work having an impact in this fallen world, but they're just because of their inadequate eschatology, they're just putting it in all the wrong places.
Yeah, I think that's what's going on. And again, you know, you actually read the literature, you see like 90% of it is just that stuff that we all agree with anyway. Yeah. So that's what sort of de-escalates it in my view. And then you can really get down to the thing that you disagree on. But you know what? Even that level of disagreement, it's okay. You know, because look, within the Reformed Church, I mean, you've got post-millennialism, you got premillennialism, you got every kind of millennialism, you've got this, you got that. So we got a lot of disagreement. So it just sort of downplays the disagreement. Go, okay, well, we disagree on that point. But, you know, it just helpfully pinpoints where that disagreement lies. And, you know, it might just be that everyone has to kind of work this out for themselves and figure out. Thankfully, it's one of those areas that our getting right on this doesn't determine the outcome, you know, in the sense that Jesus is going to make the new creation and we'll all be there at the end and be Baptists. And
amen, brother.
You know, finally realize, you know.
Finally, everyone will know as they are known and become Baptists.
Exactly. But we appreciate a lot of the guys out there doing their thing. We don't appreciate so much the liberalism that creeps in with neo-Calvinist stuff. It seems to have a kind of, and Reformed theology in general has gone this direction as a result. I think there's this kind of, you know, because there's a almost this evolutionary sort of approach, it just comports happily with a liberal sort of way of viewing history and getting rid of any supernatural elements in the future, and, you know, and sort of let's just get our hands stuck in social action stuff. So it's getting very, very close to this. Let's create heaven here and on the earth. And, you know, maybe a more reformed version of that would be, you know, let's get into politics and let's just figure it out. And then one day the power of Jesus is such that even if he never really actually comes back, he'll be everywhere because, you know, at the end of the day, we'll be ruling from Christian government and we'll be.
The liberal stuff's nonsense. I mean, they deny a resurrection because they think that, you know, the Bible's version of the resurrection is forecasting a political change on the earth, not an actual eschatological change, which is just garbage.
So on that exact point is where the overlap lies, because, you know, that eschatological change safeguards that point, right?
Yeah.
You're always going to be relying on the blessed hope, right? That's just non-negotiable. It puts the return of Christ as like the most important thing. And I feel, to me, that feels right. And, you know, the danger is that if you start downplaying this, you know, that's going to start feeling a little bit fundamentalist to you. You know, ooh, but you're actually asking for a literal return, not getting into politics and changing society. And so it goes, you know, and you have to be careful. Now, obviously, we're not accusing every Dovidian of being liberal. That's completely not true. But there is just this, and you might say the same for us, in that we are, our tendency is to go towards that sort of recluse Anabaptist, or not Anabaptist, but monastic sort of tendency, to just kind of put our heads down and just wait for the salvation to appear. You know, we have to watch out for that, but they have to watch out for that liberal end as well. So,
No, it's good.
good.
Maybe just summing up in your conclusion, in reference to the three views that you looked at, you know, you've got
Yes.
theonomy, perspectivalism, and Dovidianism. You make four just concluding remarks, and maybe it's worth throwing those out there as we draw this section to a
Yeah,
close.
true. Yeah, I mean, we'll sort of bring it up again as we see what they've said about Klein, but in so far as we're just sort of, like, you know, I think the last four sessions, podcast episodes that we've done, we've seen, especially when you look at the theonomy thing, and but I mean, it applies to all of them so far, and that you've got this monocovenantal problem, right? That
A
Klein is not
mono
happy
problem.
with. Yeah, exactly. And you might say that all of those overlap on the matter of Vossian biblical theological methodology, in that Voss was concerned to see the multiformity and unity. There was something about the way in which all of this develops and progresses and is not static and so forth that is important to the method itself. So I think it's fair to say that Klein, you know, whatever you make of Voss, Klein himself is most faithful to Voss, and most intertwined with that methodology. So you're seeing the final result of that being, you know, monocovenantalism on the one end, and a more, you know, works grace antithesis on the other. But I think at the substance of it, it's this methodology that you have to
Yeah.
either
So
accept or
within the
reject.
Reformed camp, as people are working out these issues, Klein happens to be the most faithful to his hermeneutical method.
Yeah, I think that's definitely, I'm happy to say that 100%. Others give lip service to Voss, you know, but this is, if we're talking about who is really concerned to develop his project, I think that's Klein without a doubt. Second, you could say that there is this make of it what you want. Again, you know, leave aside whether this is good or bad, but it is true that the one who is protecting the works grace antithesis with the systematic construct that's developing here with the exegesis is Klein. You know, the others might hold it. They might say it's there, but their actual systems are giving way to something else. Is if you've got a you're losing the methodology, you're losing the covenant theology that keeps this at play. And so even if you're saying, oh yeah, of course I believe the difference between law and gospel, that, you know, what Klein is putting in place actually safeguards that point, and you lose that, and you lose it all.
Yep, definitely.
Third, we could say that
He
the
just
dot.
he best distinguishes the cultural mandate from the Great Commission.
Yeah, and we're going to see this as we go more and more. But, you know, I mean, if we've just sort of ended up saying this, I mean, if it's true that redemptive sanctity is different to cultural common grace legitimacy, well, then the mandate involved for the one is going to be different to the other. And the one is a new creation mandate, ultimately. The other one is a creation, common grace mandate. So that's going to look different. It's going to have the 10 ultimate versus ultimate eschatological ends and so forth. But let's leave that for when we get to chapter 6. And then, finally, we see, in the whole thing, I suppose Klein is more on guard than any of the other systems, maybe certainly with perspectivalism and Dovidianism, against sort of letting a philosophy sort of creep in and drive it rather than exegesis. So for Klein, he's always so concerned about accounting for the details in the text. If it's not hitting those details properly, he's not happy with it. For me, that's a healthy starting point. You know, whereas if you're coming at it from either my thing, my little, you know, brainchild here, or my, you know, my appreciation of this, you know, philosophical contention, and you're just wanting to get to the conclusion without accounting for those exegetical details, that's likely going to lead to problems. So again, we'll talk more about that. All of that stuff comes up again, and but that's a good check-in point for us.
Yeah,
Good.
sounds good.
Excellent. Thanks for sticking with us. If you are listening, we're doing well. I think we're going to make this one. I think we're going to go all the way. Woohoo! All right.